this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the October edition of the Ladies' Home Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The average American household of four produces roughly 18 pounds of garbage a day, but not mine. At least not anymore. I've got my family to slash our trash, and you can too. This article is by Peg Rosen. I'm a decent suburban foot soldier. I schlep my own bags to the supermarket, opt for eco-friendly products when they're not too pricey, and cram my family of four into the smallest, most fuel-efficient car we and our sports equipment can fit into. I'm also pretty good about garbage. At least I thought I was, until I heard about families who composted all their food scraps, washed and reused plastic bags, and even went without toilet paper to cut their contribution to our nation's overburdened landfills, sewers, and incinerators. Granted, some steps like giving up toilet paper seemed a tad extreme for most mortals, but all the eco-talk inspired me to challenge my clan. If we put our minds to it, would it really be possible to waste less, recycle better, reuse more, and reduce our three cans of garbage a week habit? My teenage sons quickly signed on to the project when they realized less trash would mean less lugging for them. My husband, who's not quite complete without a disposable Dunkin' Donuts cup in his hand, took a little longer to come around. Eventually, though, we all got on board and began our great garbage diet. It was not easy at first. At times, I think my guys were ready to mutiny. But now that we're 12 weeks in, I'm shocked by how well things have turned out, and we've learned some important lessons along the way. Lesson number one. Most of what's in the garbage isn't garbage. I wasn't at all sure where or how to get started, so I asked for help from expert Katie Edwards, director of the Waste Reduction and Recycling Program for Philadelphia. Her suggestion? A garbage autopsy to determine exactly what my household has been throwing away. And I was shocked when she offered to come over and do the job for me. As Katie and I donned rubber gloves and sorted through my family's icky mess, it quickly became obvious that the lion's share fell into two categories. Compostable organic stuff, like pineapple tops, eggshells, and coffee grounds, and paper scraps that I could have been recycling. Then there were the curious little groupings Katie made. An old key to who knows what door, a bed spring, which is apparently candidate for the town scrap metal recycling bin, and a sad single sock with a hole in the toe. I was surprised to learn that clothing charities aren't insulted when they get stained, useless garments like this. They earn a pretty penny selling them to textile recyclers. The small tangle of true garbage that remained, maybe one-sixth of the original bulk, included used paper napkins, a chicken carcass, and some non-recyclable plastics like frozen vegetable bags. And even these, suggested Katie, the garbage lady, didn't really have to be there. More on that later. Lesson two. Cutting down on garbage doesn't have to be all or nothing. I and the biggest pile in front of us, most made up of mostly veggie and food scraps, Katie uttered the word I had been dreading. Compost. Ugh. I half expected her to write me off when she saw me grimace. But Katie's response was reassuring. If composting doesn't work for your family, no problem. Do you think you can try to get the paper out of your trash? She asked. Smart environmentalist. I soon learned, don't disparage those who aren't as hardcore as they are. If they do, people like me will feel intimidated. They won't bother doing anything at all. Any change that works for a family's lifestyle and budget, for example, reusing Ziploc bags, makes a difference. Lesson 3. Earth mothers aren't the only ones who compost. I actually did cave in on the composting issue, but only because I cook so much that I knew that was where I could really make a dent. Besides, the flowers in my garden would appreciate it. And now that I've been composting for a few months, this decidedly non-Birkenstock-wearing, somewhat germophobic mom is here to tell you. It's no big deal. I simply dialed up one of the many online on-site sites that sell composting equipment, and the customer service people helped me pinpoint exactly what kind of compositor bin and paraphernalia would suit my needs. The options range from $40 for a simple bin to $400 for a weather-tight insulated container. When my goodies arrived, the nice folks at gardeners.com walked me through the setup, advised me where to put the compost. Most people opt for outside, though some bins are specially designed to be used in garbages or back porches, and taught me through the basics of what would go in it. If you want to save money, check to see if your town sells composters at a discount, or skip the bin altogether, keep a scrap heap in the corner of your yard, and turn it every so often with a rake. Lesson 4. Convenience is everything. No kid, no husband, heck, no mom is going to walk halfway across the house to properly dispose of toilet paper rolls or a gum wrapper. So I knew I had to create satellite recycling stations, especially on the second floor. I hit my local discount store and snagged $3 baskets for every room, which I designated for scrap paper. The night before the recycling bin gets dragged to the curb, my younger son now simply rounds up newspapers, catalogs, discarded mail, and other stray pieces of paper from around the house and dumps it into the regular lidded garbage can marked paper that I've conveniently placed right outside the back door. Lesson 5. My town's recycling rules aren't your town's recycling rules. While just about everything is technically recyclable, some towns collect only those items they can find a buyer for. Take a little time to learn your town's rules. Many post them on their municipal website. If you're confused, call and ask questions. You can also ask for recycling alternatives. I've learned that Whole Foods has a drop-off box for number 5 plastics, like yogurt containers, which many towns don't accept for recycling. I also discovered that even though my town doesn't collect scrap metal curbside, I could drop them off at the dump on Saturdays. And many dry cleaners will recycle your old wire hangers. If driving around town with your oddball stuff sounds like too much trouble, don't sweat it. Just getting the basic paper, metals, and plastic that your municipality does recycle into the right bin is a huge step. Lesson 6. Recycling is only one of the R's. I always thought that being good about garbage meant being good about recycling, but I've quickly learned that recycling is just one piece of the puzzle. There's less to recycle if we reduce what we bring into our homes, reuse what we can, and refuse to buy products that are excessively packaged or not recyclable. So I began to cut down. I signed up for online bill paying, put myself on the no junk mail lists, and canceled dozens of catalogs. I rethought what I bought. Did I really need a big plastic bottle of juice when I could buy the concentrate in a small can? Why buy stacks of individually wrapped American cheese slices when I could get singles at the deli counter instead? I even brought my own plastic container, and yes, at first, the deli guy thought I was nuts, but he's used to me now. I started bringing reusable bags not just to the supermarket, but also to the mall, the houseware store, and the pharmacy. Often I do without a bag altogether. Just last week, I bought a pint of scotch for a recipe and reflectively stowed the bottle in my coat pocket. So I got a few looks as I walked out the store. Big deal. At home, I stocked up on dish towels, rounded up rags, unearthed old cloth napkins, and kissed paper products farewell, though I keep a secret stash of paper towels for really gross dog-related messes. Rinsing and reusing plastic containers and bags means I use less foil and plastic wrap. And those chicken carcasses, how did I ever throw my bones? Why did I never throw my bones into boiling water and make my own stock? All of this is common sense. It's how our grandparents lived when thrift was a virtue and no waste was a way of life. Lesson 7. It gets easier. Things were a little hairy at the start of our garbage diet. Deciphering exactly what number was inside the little triangle on each piece of plastic was a pain, and I spent a fair amount of time plucking recyclables out of the trash. I have a distinct memory of my husband standing in our bedroom waving a Q-tip over his head and saying, "I don't know where this goes." But after about 3 nutty weeks of chaos, things began to subside. Since I generally buy the same stuff all the time, each of us has begun to recognize which plastics went where without having to go triangle hunting. Paper wound up where it belonged, when my husband actually remembered to take his own reusable to-go cup to Dunkin' Donuts, I knew we were on a roll. Lesson 8. One change leads to another. When I put my family up to this garbage challenge, I was intent on reducing our 3 weekly curbside cans by 1. I'm proud to say we have massively surpassed that goal. Emptying the kitchen trash can once, a nearly daily chore, has become a weekly chore, and only because the bags get stinky, not because it's full. Those 3 big cans that we hauled out to the curb every week have dwindled to a single container so light on trash that our biggest concern is that it might blow over. But here's the real surprise. Suddenly, doing the right thing for the environment doesn't feel like a burden. Sure, my efforts can seem futile when I spot row after row of trash cans lining our street and see the mountains of litter generated by one little league baseball game. But at the same time, we've inspired 4 friends to start their own family garbage diet. 2 of them are even composting. Change always starts somewhere. So it might as well be the word can. Don't trash these, though. These items can't always be recycled, but they don't belong in the garbage either. Here's how and where to pass them on. Fluorescent light bulbs. Fluorescent light bulbs contain small amounts of mercury, so they can't be tossed in the regular trash. Go to lamprecycle.org to search for recycling locations near you, and you can take any unbroken bulbs to Home Depot. Packing peanuts. Packing peanuts made from vegetable derivatives can be dissolved in water. Many UPS or mailboxes stores will recycle those made from plastic. Call the peanut hotline at 800-828-2214 for recycling locations. Dead batteries. Recycle dead batteries at your local electronics store. Now for the family health buzz, your healing voice. If your daughter is stressed out, the soothing sound of your voice can relieve her anxiety as much as an actual hug, says the University of Wisconsin at Madison. After a series of challenging tests, girls who were comforted by their mom in person or over the phone experienced a surge in oxytocin, the bonding hormone that also calms your stress response. In contrast, girls who had no contact with their mother showed no rise in oxytocin. So if you can't be there, speed dial your daughter after her difficult exam, important performance, or other big event, or tell her to call you. Sports injury shocker. Overuse injuries in teens and teen athletes, such as tennis elbow, swimmer's shoulders, Achilles tendonitis, have quadrupled in the past 5 years. Many experts think sports specialization is to blame. As more and more teens participate in just one activity all year round, their developing bodies never get a chance to properly cross-train, rest, or repair themselves. The American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine has spearheaded a prevention campaign at StopSportsInjuries.org that offers these three tips. Tip number one, insight for parents and kids on how much practice or play is too much. There's a resource for coaches to help teach kids safe ways to participate. And three, on this website, there are prevention tip sheets for baseball, cheerleading, hockey, soccer, volleyball, and other sports with high rates of overuse and trauma injuries. Susan Gregg Gilmore and her daughter knew that they had a genetic mutation that causes cancer. The question was, what were they going to do about it? This article is called Tough Choices by Margaret Wrinkle. Everyone who knew Susan Gregg Gilmore's mother-in-law, Martha, was inspired by her determination, generosity, and faith. As the first ordained female Southern Baptist minister in North Texas, she helped her community by registering voters and feeding the homeless. Even after she was diagnosed with breast cancer at 60, and then, almost a year later, with ovarian cancer, she remained a tireless public servant. For nearly a decade, she battled a disease that often claims its victims in a matter of months. When she died in June of 2007 at age 71, more than 1,500 people were at her funeral. To Martha's son, Dan Gilmore, an attorney, and his wife, Susan Gregg Gilmore, a novelist, Martha was an ideal model for her three daughters, Claudia, Josephine, and Alice. Now 23, 18, and 16. If the girls had inherited even a fraction of their grandmother's energy, drive, and passion to better the world, their future would be bright. Unfortunately, as Susan and Dan learned shortly after his mother's death, Martha Gilmore left behind not just an inspiring example, but also a devastating legacy. She had passed on to Dan the gene mutation that made her vulnerable to cancer. And he had passed it on to Claudia. Martha Gilmore had no family history of breast or ovarian cancer, but having two separate cancers is a red flag for gene-related disease. So before she died, her oncologist suggested that she be tested for the harmful changes in her BRCA1 and her BRCA2 genes. These mutations are strongly correlated with an increased risk of breast and ovarian cancers. A woman's lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is ordinarily about 12%. But for women with certain BRCA mutations, the risk of developing cancer is 50 to 85%. For ovarian cancer, the increased risk is higher. A harmful BRCA mutation raises a woman's likelihood of developing ovarian cancer from 1.4% to an astonishing 40 to 60%. When a blood test revealed that Martha did indeed have the BRCA1 mutation, she sent Dan information about the genetic test and its implications. Many women, even many doctors, are not aware that a family history of breast and ovarian cancer can be passed on through men. When one parent, mother or father, carries a BRCA mutation, there's a 50-50 chance a child of either sex will inherit it. I have three daughters, so my mother knew how devastating this news could be to our family, Dan says. Still, he couldn't bring himself to get his own genetic analysis. If the result was positive, it would mean that his daughters would be needed to be tested, since their chance of inheriting the mutation would be 50-50. I pushed it out of my mind because I didn't want to face what it meant, says Dan. After Martha's death, it was Susan who encouraged him to have the test. Most patients with BRCA1 mutations develop cancer at a much younger age than Martha did. In fact, one of the worst repercussions of carrying the mutation is that such cancers are more likely to occur before menopause when they are faster growing and more resistant to treatment. I don't want to watch my daughters die like I just watched my mother-in-law, Susan says. I kept telling Dan, we have to know. Dan relented and scheduled the test for early August, but because of a hospital mix-up, it was early November before they got the call. Dan shared his mother's faulty BRCA1 gene. I fell apart, Susan says. Even though there's still a 50% chance that each of her daughters was safe, Susan couldn't think of a worst-case scenario. In that moment, I was angry at Dan. I was angry at his mother. I was angry at cancer that had already haunted us for years and was never going to leave us alone. I kept thinking, oh my God, I have three girls. It didn't help that Dan's reaction was so different from Susan's. He felt his role was to be the strong one, to focus on the day-to-day. The attitude that made Susan feel more afraid. Dan was trying just to carry on. That was how he coped. But I was like, what's wrong with you? Don't you care? Before they told their daughters, Susan and Dan met with a genetics nurse who supported Susan's decision to look at her own family tree for a clearer picture of what her daughters might face. That's when issues got really complicated. Susan's maternal aunt, she suddenly remembered, had died of ovarian cancer at 52. Her maternal grandmother had died in her early 30s of unknown causes. So in January of 2008, Susan, who was 46, got tested as well. It was unlikely that she had a BRCA mutation. Her mother, sisters, and many female cousins were fine. But right then she needed confirmation of her family's good health. To add to the turmoil, Susan's first novel, Looking for Salvation at Dairy Queen, was about to be published, and she was facing a grueling book tour. The additional stress of waiting for these test results was almost too much to bear. Finally, the genetics nurse called. Susan had an abnormal BRCA2 gene. But the news wasn't clear-cut. There are different types of variations in the 1 and 2 genes. Some, like Dan's, are known to increase the risk of breast ovarian cancers. Others are benign. They aren't associated with cancer at all. And there's a third group called variants of uncertain significance. They look different from normal BRCA, but doctors don't know whether they are dangerous or not. Susan had inherited a variant from that group. It was hugely frustrating, she said. I really didn't know what to do, how to get clarity. It took months, but finally Susan reached a decision. With a family history of ovarian cancer and a gene different of some kind, she felt it made sense to go ahead with a oophorectomy. But she wanted to keep her breast. Her doctor supported her decision. There are many ways to screen for breast cancer, mammograms, ultrasounds, MRI, and regular breast exams, but there's no real good test for ovarian cancer, which is rarely caught early enough to be cured. For Susan, the decision was clear. I had my children. I wasn't that far from menopause, and I'd seen too much ovarian cancer. My ovaries had to go. But first, she had to tell her oldest daughter some news. In the spring of 2008, Claudia was a junior at Georgetown University, far from all the turmoil her parents were going through in Tennessee. By now, 21, she was also the only Gilmore daughter old enough to be tested. Because the mutation doesn't cause health issues in children, doctors don't test for it before your 18th birthday. One day in May, while the three of them were having lunch, Susan and Dan finally told Claudia the news that had shaken them. Claudia didn't know what to think. My first reaction was that it was just way too big and too scary to contemplate. But then I thought, wait a minute. In college, they teach me knowledge is power. I'd be stupid not to look into this, so I made up my mind in 10 minutes. Yep, I'm going to take the test. That August, Susan had the oophorectomy, and Claudia came home to take a blood test she would assume that would rule out both her father's gene mutation and her mother's. And then I kind of put it behind me, she said. I was 21. But she couldn't put it behind her for long. A couple of weeks later, she got a call from the genetic counselor with the news that she had inherited her grandmother's mutation. After I hung up, everything was just a fog, she said. I felt like it was a death sentence. When she heard the news about her daughter, Susan fell apart. By this time, I cried for only a day or two. I knew this was life-saving information. I was not going to lose my daughter. As Claudia quickly learned, the protocol for women with BRCA mutations was to do nothing until age 25. After that, to begin a regimen of screenings, mammographies, and ultrasounds every 6 months. Then at 35, women are advised to consider getting a double mastectomy, followed by the oophorectomy at 40. But the more Claudia learned about her mutation, the more she encountered stories of women who developed cancer at an age younger. And when you met a woman who was diagnosed with breast cancer at 24, the wait-and-see approach was a bit terrifying. Which is why Claudia, after 2 years of research and talking with other women at high risk for breast and ovarian cancer, has made a decision that goes against part of the usual protocol. Because she hopes to marry and have children, she followed the recommendations for the oophorectomy, but she's not waiting for the mastectomy. This January, she will have time off from her job, and Claudia will be recovering for an operation in which both of her healthy breasts will be removed and reconstructed. The surgery will reduce her risk of developing cancer, breast cancer, for up to 80%. As she wrote on her first post at Previve.com, a blog she started, I have grown anxious to do something to annihilate the chance of having cancer. But there are more benefits to double mastectomy than avoiding cancer. Every patient has a different level of anxiety. But if you know you have 80% chance of developing breast cancer, that's a pretty big dark cloud to have hanging over your head. Susan admits she was relieved by Claudia's decision. As soon as she started talking about it, I was 100% behind her, Susan said. Claudia feels a better quality of life will come from having this done and moving on, and I get that. As her mother, I'll be able to rest more easily, too. Dan is just amazed at his daughter's courage. I couldn't be more proud of her, she said. But not everyone has been supportive of Claudia's choice to act now. One doctor begged her, "Promise me you'll make a decision not to make a decision. You don't have to do this." And Claudia understood the point. New research has uncovered a less radical means of managing the risk before she reaches the age when cancer is more likely. And this decision has ramifications that go beyond the pain of surgery. Breast reconstruction is a tough process. It will take months for her tissues to expand enough to accept the implants, and she'll need an additional surgery to remove the tissue expanders and insert the implants. In addition, Claudia's new breast tissue won't be capable of sexual response, and she won't be able to nurse her babies. Then there's the question of dating. Fortunately, Claudia's male friends have been totally understanding. In fact, she's coming to see this situation as a great way to weed out the good guys from the losers. If I had been able to present this to some boys I've dated in the past, I might not waste time with them. As she waits, Claudia turns for support to her parents and friends, including many she has met through a group called Bright Pink, a national advocacy organization specifically for young women at high risk of breast and ovarian cancer. In the process, she has become a resource for others who are going through the same thing. She says, "I am grateful that there is a sisterhood here for Claudia," says Susan. As for Claudia's actual sisters, neither has been tested for the mutation, and Claudia is cautious about sharing details with them. "They should not have to go through this," she said. "They should be thinking about good grades and fun parties. When they're ready to talk about it, I know they'll come to me. And if either of them ever has to go through this, I'm grateful that I'll be able to help them figure it out." You may meet Claudia and watch a video on the Lady Home Journal website. Go to lhj.com/videos, and her name is Claudia. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of From Soups to Nuts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.